An estimated 500,000 people have died of COVID-19 in the United States. That's roughly equivalent to the population of Atlanta, Georgia. The total number of deaths worldwide is approximately 2.5 million, so the United States is responsible for 1 in 5 of the people who have died during the pandemic. The first documented deaths of COVID-19 in the United States occurred in Santa Clara County, California in early February, and then in Seattle, Washington on Friday, February 28, 2020. At the one-year anniversary of these first deaths, I'm joined by Elizabeth McNamara and Suzanne Watnick of Northwest Kidney Centers in Seattle. Liz is Vice President of Patient Care Services and Chief Nursing Officer, and Suzanne is Chief Medical Officer. Liz, I'd like to start with you. When you think back to last February, what comes to mind?
I think the first thing that comes to mind is still that sense of absolute shock. We were absolutely shocked that night when we got the call. We didn't anticipate being impacted so quickly. And the other thing that comes to my mind is that it feels like a really long time ago.
Suzanne, from your perspective, as you think back to a year ago, what worked well?
You know, it's so interesting to think back about that question, because the thoughts that go through my mind are not only what worked well, but what were the barriers and what were the challenges. And I think that that's how the entire year has gone. It's hard to reflect back on so many of these questions. You know, when I reflect back, as we approach this year mark, we were aware of our first patient who passed from COVID. I think of it almost like bookends. I remember 9 p.m. on that Friday evening when we found out about our first patient, and I'm reflecting back on receiving vaccine, which we've just done. And to think about the fact that that is 1 year is really remarkable, to go from addressing a pandemic with very few weapons aside from what we already knew about infection prevention and control, and to think about everything that we've stood up since then. Really, the emotions had to be put aside to some degree, Todd. And as we sat in the first days when the CDC arrived out and really shoulder to shoulder to work with us, it worked well to have partners with whom we could say we're in this together. And then the circles that we drew in terms of partners kept being wider and wider. So at first it was with the CDC, and then it was other local providers in the community, and then it was other dialysis organizations with whom we worked closely, and other community providers. And I think that the amazing energy and true grit of everybody that we worked with is part of what worked well. Creating principles up front is something that worked very well, because no matter the emotion that was packed up in everything that we saw, the people that suffered, not just patients, but our staff as well, we could rest back on our three principles, which were that we were going to provide dialysis no matter the hurdles. It was our obligation, that we were going to lean into the science to provide best care. And also, thirdly, to provide the leadership through education and transparency and open communications really helped to provide some type of platform where you could plant your feet and gain some amount of confidence at a time where it felt like the rug was being pulled out from underneath.
So, Suzanne, if you could do one thing differently during the last year, what would that one thing be?
I think more than anything, making sure we were always in front with communications. Who haven't we communicated with? And there were definitely times, Liz, I know you can speak to this along with all of the times that I may have forgotten to communicate to certain people. That has been key. It's been both a success for us and the places where we haven't done as well as we could have.
And Liz, how about for you? If it's in addition to communications, what would you do differently in retrospect?
Ooh, that's a really great question. I think one of the things that I would have done differently earlier is universal masking and eyewear for the staff. The staff were always masked. We didn't universally mask the patients early on in those days because that wasn't what the science was telling us. So I wish we had known sooner. I think the one gap we had around messaging is really getting to all the patients, you know, and really getting to all the patients in a way that they heard us and that they heard things. You know, you make assumptions as a leader, but you really have to circle back and go back and make sure that everybody hears you. And that's a challenge.
And I'm just curious, Liz, how would you change your approach to patient care as a result of this experience? If you kind of widen the lens and just think big picture as you care for patients in the future, what's going to be fundamentally different?
Oh, boy, I think a lot's going to be fundamentally different. I don't think we're going to go back to not masking. I don't think we're going to go back to not cleaning as often as we have. I mean, I think that's the reason why we didn't see very much flu this past year, because we actually have better infection control in the clinics now than I think we ever did. So none of that's going to change, really, in terms of how we care for patients.
One of the topics that I think the pandemic has raised is issues around health disparities and inequities. And so you look at the disproportionate burden of COVID-19 on underrepresented minorities, the lack of access to vaccines when compared to other patient populations, the lack of access to telehealth, and then the lack of access to home dialysis. On the one hand, it seems like all these trends have gotten worse as a result of what's happened during the last year, but there is some optimism for the future. So I guess just starting with you, Suzanne, how would you respond to the appropriate criticism that the medical community really hasn't addressed these issues as directly and effectively as it should?
I think first and foremost, we have to own it. They do exist. And you can look at it for the nation and say, oh, it's not in our backyard, but that's not the case. How can we do better? And I think one of the primary ways that we have to start is a theme I think we've been touching on during this call, which is making sure we're communicating with patients and what would work for them. How do we need to be more flexible as a healthcare entity to make it such that patients can pursue whatever option feels best to them, no matter the current potential hurdles? You know, how can we work with our staff? We just had a staff survey specifically asking questions around this. So how can we make sure that not only patients feel that they are represented and have a voice, but also how the patients can work with staff and how staff feel that they have a voice, no matter where they are coming from, so that they feel that there is appropriate equity in terms of how we're treating everybody in the organization. I think that there's a lot that can be done. There are examples in other disciplines, but there's a far way to go.
Yeah, I think the key to start is the data. I think you have to be able to look at your data, and I think that we all have an obligation to actually look at our data. We have to have a standard way to even document race and ethnicity for not only our patients, but for our staff. And then you have to pull that data apart. We did that probably around March of last year, and we found a profound difference between our Spanish-speaking and our Latinx patient population than basically the rest of the population in who was acquiring COVID. A lot of different reasons, but that forced us to go back, readdress that within the language, use interpreters, use that kind of stuff to really reach out to these folks. We joined a roundtable just to talk and say, how can you help us, Latina patient population, help us get to these folks in a way that they can hear us and in the way they can trust us and in the way that they can trust basically the information coming to them. So I think, quite honestly, I think the feedback is accurate to the medical community, and I think we have to lead data forward, and we have to look under the hood and we have to be humble about it because we've got plenty of work to do. Well, I also think, Todd, as it plays out, and I think that I see it with the vaccine allocation right? I mean, we've worked really hard to try to get the ESKD patients moved up in each of the states, right? The states are all doing something completely different. And it's really hard when you can basically give the vaccine to somebody 65 or older, but not a relatively healthy, quote unquote, healthy patient on dialysis. That's like 55. That doesn't make sense that this particular patient population, they really are getting left behind. So, and that really highlights that really increases the disparities that we're seeing in our current healthcare system right now.
So just to focus on vaccines for a second, and Liz, I think you've articulated well what the challenge has been and the disappointment from the community. What I'm trying to figure out, and I'm just curious if either of you are thinking about it from this perspective, is how much of the challenge in getting the vaccines to prioritizing the dialysis population, how much of the challenge is a result of the fact that there's just less awareness and public interest in kidney diseases and kidney failure than other chronic diseases? So that's sort of one issue. And then the second issue is just, you know, is Suzanne said earlier, you know, it's amazing that within a year there are two vaccines and more coming. At the same time, there have been real challenges with the logistics and the distribution. And I'm just trying to balance those two issues. And I'm curious, maybe Liz, I'll start with you and then go to Suzanne, sort of your reaction to those observations.
Yeah, it's that has also been quite a journey. And so we've been involved with the state for months now. And it's hard because when you take a step back and you take a big, broader perspective, everybody's trying to advocate for their patient population, right? I totally get that. We really try to play by the state's rules, right? And say that we will do the phases. But I think you're right. There's just a small subset of people that actually are interested / aware of our patients and really don't understand. They can't go to mass vaccine clinics, right? Most of our patients require public transportation to even get to dialysis. So they can't make an additional appointment. And so you feel like you're saying the same thing over and over to basically whoever will listen to really help them understand what this patient population goes through and does. Suzanne?
Yeah. And on that note, I think that the biggest failure of thinking about vaccine for our patients with kidney disease was a failure to advocate very early on. For example, the ACIP, the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, was the group that advised the CDC on what the various stages were. And they did not have somebody speaking to them early on behalf of people with kidney disease. There were people speaking about patients in skilled nursing facilities who had a much higher mortality rate and hospitalization rate, but that was the same for our patient population. At that point in time, dialysis patients were 7 times more likely to be hospitalized than Medicare patients over 65, but nobody had brought that to the table. Nobody had advocated for our patients early on, and I think that's a lesson learned. Now, the government is hearing a lot about our patients, but it took too long. So I think in the future, this is a place that we need to make sure that we're not only advocating as the issue is coming up for distribution, but prior to that, as we're drafting first principles in the country about how we care for vulnerable patients. And that's who our patients are. They're vulnerable, they're socioeconomically disadvantaged. There are tremendous issues around equity and disparities in our population. So yes, wonderful that it gives us that opportunity, but it is saddening to know that we weren't at that table early enough.
Yeah, and it was really disappointing to me that the Biden-Harris administration didn't include a nephrologist or a nephrology nurse or someone with expertise in both kidney medicine and the patient population as part of its COVID-19 health equity task force. I mean, I think it gets to this larger point, which is I think increasingly the administration and others recognize the vulnerability of the patient population, but it just hasn't gotten to the level of we need to get to the point where when they're putting together a task force like this, they think to themselves, we can't not have nephrology there. We cannot have the dialysis population there. And that's, I think, the challenge, not just for ASN, but for our community. I just want to circle back to something I probably should have asked earlier, which is, and Suzanne, maybe I'll start with you, as you think about medical education for physicians, and then Liz, I'll ask you for nurses, and then just in general, as we think about sort of healthcare education, how is it going to change as a result of the pandemic, but then specifically in terms of, as we think about nephrology or kidney medicine, how is that educational experience going to change as a result of what's happened over the last year?
Well, it already has changed. It already has changed. And, I think about our fellows and all they've gone through in the last year. The fellows that we have had already been on the front lines as medical residents, caring for people with COVID or under different types of rotations because of the pandemic, unable to be front lines sometimes, but having to be front lines in a place that they never suspected that they would be. And just as we've talked about so many things that are probably going to change as a result of the pandemic, even, years from now, I think, yes, there'll be opportunities. There'll be more opportunities for tele-education, for example, so that our trainees can go to different sites and still receive the type of education that really is facilitated by a group and yet be able to have experiences, far away. However, are we going to be able to provide opportunities for trainees in the same way that we did before if we have more stringent infection prevention and control measures in place? There should be fewer people in a room, for example. They won't have the opportunity to observe. And just in terms of additional education overall, I think infectious disease is going to be seen in a different way as a subspecialty. I think the value of it is tremendous, but I think more and more people around the nation, even outside of healthcare, are recognizing how important it is. And I think that as a group that cares for people with kidney disease and educates physicians, making sure that either they have that knowledge or they consult the right physicians that have the right training is going to be something that they'll pay attention to more so. For example, we were so fortunate to have you, Liz, as somebody who is the expert in infection prevention and control, lead our organization. I don't know what we would have done without you. And we were fortunate to have somebody with deep expertise. Liz, what do you think about the training that'll happen from a nursing perspective as we move forward?
Yeah, when I think about nursing education, that's actually where I start to feel some hope, quite honestly. And I think that the schools are well beyond our current system, really in terms of equity, diversity. That's at the forefront of the majority of nursing programs. I think nephrology nursing is untapped, quite honestly. I think we could do a better job getting students into the outpatient clinics for sure, associated with home. We have had probably 10 or 12 students this past year doing a year-long course on, basically social determinants of health. And so that's been amazing, having this energy in our space here, helping us move forward. I think the ability to educate remotely is key. I think that we're just going to have to adapt having people in the space, and I think we're just going to have to be okay with that, because there's no way you can really learn the nuts and bolts of how to assess a patient when you're not in the clinic from a nursing perspective. So I do feel hopeful. I think it's funny you said that about the ID docs, because I think the key is really not to stay siloed in your own discipline. When you think about the AKIP folks too, right? Getting to the table, just because you're an expert in the heart, for example, doesn't mean you're an expert in ID. So I think we as an organization really need to rely on those partnerships ebb and flow, which I think is when we've been most successful, right? We're not making these decisions in a silo. So I think that's a key takeaway, I think, as we move forward.
Yeah, well, that brings us right back to where we started about the issues around communication and breaking down those silos.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's been a tremendous theme throughout nephrology, making sure, for example, you're breaking down the silos between dialysis and transplantation, between CKD care, and making sure it's a seamless flow. Because again, you're thinking about a patient throughout his or her life with kidney disease, not a patient on dialysis or a patient in transplant. Yep. Same goes for the care providers, the nurses, the technicians, the physicians. How can we work together as a community? And I think that is a huge lesson learned. The more that we've been able to communicate and work together, the better we've been able to address all of these unanticipated concerns, conundrums that have come up day after day. How do we store a vaccine? How do we get it from one place to the other? How do we communicate to make sure we understand who received a vaccine in a nursing facility so that we don't double dose them in a dialysis chair, for example? So it goes on and on. And I think that that is a universal theme that we have to recognize as we make it through this time.
Well, Liz, Suzanne, thank you very much for taking the time to talk. And it really just sounds like, as you said, it's been a long year. And it's just remarkable when you think about where we were last year at this time and where we are now. And I guess just to give each of you the final word quickly, I'm curious as to where you think we'll be a year from now. So, Liz, I'll start with you.
I hope we'll be at a place in a year where we're not constantly watching curves. I hope we're at a place where our staff can actually fly someplace to actually get a break. That's my hope of where we'll be in a year. And I hope in a year we can proactively look at what we need to do next step rather than reactively respond.
And I have to echo that last message, the idea of being able to be planful as opposed to constantly having a feeling like a rug is being pulled out from underneath as a new issue arises. I look forward to that. I look forward to some of the innovation that's happened over the last year to become more ingrained. And I look forward to understanding how I hope that all of the lessons learned can be used to take better care of our patients.
Well, thanks again. I really appreciate it.